Everyone, I made the mistake of meeting Josh at the sink and asking him if I could borrow his fez for this sheet wear. And he said yes. So I'm a little out of my comfort zone, to be honest, but I figured I'd go with a prop since it is Purim coming up and the rest of it. The tassel thing is really annoying, though, that I'll tell you. Get used to it, right. All right, so this is what I want to do this morning. We're going to do an overview of Megillat Esther, which is a big project in its own right, but I have a specific goal in mind in doing that, and it's to attempt to unravel what might be termed one of the Megillot's greatest mysteries, which is the absence of God's name. I don't want to make too much out of this, but I think you appreciate at this point that Jewish text, certainly biblical text, tends to focus its attention on God and his role. Sometimes he is upset and disappointed. Sometimes he is happy and encouraged. Sometimes he is less active, sometimes more active, but God is always somewhere in the story in an explicit way. And when we talk about Megillat Esther, we discover that there is no mention of God's name whatsoever. It is an anomaly. The only other biblical text that comes close is the Song of Songs. But the Song of Songs does have one mention of God's name towards the very end, where love is described as a consuming fire, a shalhevet yah, a fire of God. And when we talk about Megillat Esther, there isn't even that. I'm going to sharpen the question a little bit later by demonstrating that the absence of God's name is not simply an omission, but actually a commission, as we will see. But before we do that, I just want to very briefly outline the events of the Megillah. Because when we do that, we discover some surprising features of the story that are not immediately obvious. So in doing this, if you have a Megillah in front of you, it will be helpful. If you don't, just follow along. Maybe you know the story, or maybe you don't. My goal is to create some sort of a timeline for the events of the Megillah and to begin to appreciate how they unfold. The Megillah opens in the third year of the king's reign, King Ahasuerus. And in the third year, for reasons which the Megillah does not make explicit, Ahasuerus decides to throw a banquet. I guess you might call it the mother of all banquets if you want. It's 180 days. And it is for Sarava Avadav, all of his ministers, all of his servants, anyone who is anyone within the bureaucracy of the Persian government. And that lasts for half a year. Whenever we have a mishteh, I'm going to put a mem because I think it's important to track the mishtaot or the banquets. Sometimes in this example, they are extravagant. Sometimes they're a little more modest. But one of the things we will discover is that the idea of Mishteh seems to punctuate the story of Megillat Esther from the beginning to the end. In the immediate aftermath of the 180-day banquet, he throws another banquet for 7 days. This one for the people who live in Shushan. And they just have the run of the palace grounds. It's sort of like opening up Buckingham Palace to every single person who lives in London and letting them run wild for 7 days. That's what it's like. So the first party for the ministers, for the higher-ups, the second party for the people that live in the capital of Shushan. And simultaneous with this, but I can't tell you exactly when it begins or when it ends, is Vashti's mishteh. So this also is a mem for mishteh. And then Vashti, who throws her own mishteh, a mishteh for the women. Okay? So, it's at the conclusion of this one, which I guess might be the conclusion of that one too, I'm not really sure, that Vashti is summoned. Okay? It really is the last possible moment. One might have wondered what would have happened if she would have been summoned on the third day instead of the seventh or the fourth day. I don't know. I get the sense that the intention was to create some sort of a climactic close to the festivities. And so it's on the seventh day, and only on the seventh day, that Vashti is summoned to appear before the ministers in order to show her beauty. Okay, she refuses. And of course, that refusal is what triggers the events that follow. Pretty much, this is chapter 1 in the Megillah. Chapter 2 is the story of choosing a new queen, which turns out to be a very long and involved process in which the king harnesses the entire state apparatus to gather all these virgins to Shushan. If it were another context, we might call it state-sponsored rape, because that's really what it is, even though we tend to portray it as being almost a Cinderella-esque fairy tale, but it's not really. Okay, the women are brought to Shushan, whether they like it or not, in order for the king to choose who will be the queen. But the choice isn't just a beauty contest, it's also a sleeping contest. And it's not until the end of that that Esther is ultimately selected. Okay? It's in the seventh year that Esther is brought to the palace, not to be queen, but just as one of the women who are in the running, Vatilakach Esther. And I want to point out that, of course, there's no choice involved, just as there's no choice for any other woman in the story. Okay, that happens in the seventh year, in the tenth month, which parenthetically the Megillah tells us is the month of Tevet. So I want to note that as well. Whenever we talk about months in Megillat Esther, we give them two designations. First of all, we give them a number. And second of all, we give them a name. And this is unusual for reasons which we will see. Okay? In the end, Esther will be chosen. Okay? This is all happening in the seventh year. Which means, by the way, that 4 years have elapsed since the opening events. I take that to mean, but I'm not certain of the exact details, that the king has sort of been playing this game for 4 years running. You'd think he might have more important things to do, ruling over 127 provinces, but apparently not. Okay, so this is a 4-year contest until Esther is ultimately chosen. And when she is chosen, the text tells us, Vayas Hamelech Mishteh. He makes a Mishteh lechol sarava avadav et Mishteh Esther. Okay, so this is the banquet in honor of Esther. Okay, it's number 4 in the list of Mishtaot in the Megillah. And she is installed as queen, whatever that means. King still has his harem, obviously, but she is the favorite, I suppose. Okay? Chapter 2 ends with the plot against the king uncovered by Mordechai, who reveals it to Esther, who reveals it to the king, but the king never makes the connection, nor does Esther. And as this whole thing unfolds, she keeps her identity hidden, which is, of course, going to be a theme in the story. Right? Identity which is concealed, identity which is revealed, right? And at what moment we make that transition from one to the other. Chapter 3 introduces us to Haman. Well done. Okay. And in chapter 3 we meet Haman, and he immediately is presented as the king's right-hand man, the king's enforcer, all of the king's servants and ministers bow down to Haman except for Mordechai, which makes Haman very upset. In the 12th year, Haman acts. Okay? So, believe it or not, 5 years have elapsed since Esther was made queen. 9 years have elapsed since the story began. We're only in chapter 3. Okay? Haman casts lots. He peeled Pur, which the text tells us is the goral, that is to say the lot. Okay? And what does he determine by casting that lot? That the most auspicious time for destroying the Jews is going to be the month of Adar. Haman casts the lots, we're told, Bachodesh HaRishon, the first month of the 12th year, that is the month of Nisan. Okay, so he casts those lots. And the lots tell him the date which he will now reserve for the destruction of the Jews. What will that date be? It will be the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day. Okay? So that is the date determined by the lots for the Jews' destruction. Now note, of course, as luck would have it, the lot is cast in Nisan, which is the first month. The date of destruction is in Adar, which is 12 months later, which means, basically, the Jews have a lot of time to somehow turn the story around. If the lot would have fallen on the second month, let's say, it probably would have been a different story. So somehow there is, as it were, some kind of a coincidence, if you will, but only in hindsight, that by the lot falling 12 months later, we have pretty much a year to turn the story around. Okay? Haman will win the king's permission to destroy the Jews. And on the first month, on the 13th day, okay, the scribes are summoned and the decree is publicized. Okay, the decree of destruction is publicized in the kingdom. The 13th day of the first month. I don't know exactly when the lots were cast. It must have been sometime between the first day of the first month and the 13th day of the first month. Okay? But he doesn't waste any time. That's the point. After the king's permission has been secured, Haman will immediately summon the scribes. The decree will be publicized, and that begins on the 13th day of the first month, which is the month of Nisan. Parenthetically, if we were looking at it from a different perspective, we would say the scribes are summoned, the decree is published on the night of Bidikat Chametz, because that's what it is. Okay, this is the day before Erev Pesach, but you'd never know that from reading the Megillah. It's not something that the Megillah dwells upon, right? But that's the case. Okay, and immediately we're told, and with this chapter 3 ends, V'hamelech v'haman yashvu lishtot. There is another banquet. This one we might call the banquet of Haman, or Haman and the king. V'ha'ir Shushan Navocha, and the city of Shushan was in an uproar, was confused. Okay? All right, what happens next? Fourth chapter. Mordechai swings into action. He dons sackcloth. He goes out to the public square. He makes it clear that he is in a state of mourning. Esther receives word. She inquires. There's an exchange which takes place. Mordechai makes clear to her that she has to do something. If you don't do something, he says, the Jews will be saved, you'll be destroyed. Atu veitavich tovedu. And who knows, says Mordechai, maybe for just this reason did you come to the position of becoming queen. Esther says, wait a second here. If I approach the king without being summoned, the punishment is very clear. Achat dato lehamit. Right? The death sentence for whoever approaches the king without permission. Mordechai says you have to go. Esther says on one condition, right? I'm in chapter 4 now. Right? What is the condition? Lech kenosat kol ha-yehudim. Gather the Jews. And do what? Fast. For how long? 3 days. Laila vayom. Day and night. Okay, and with that, I will approach the king. V'chasher avadati, avadati, whatever happens next, happens next. And sure enough, she approaches chapter 5. And the king receives her in audience. Masha elateich, what is it that you want? Nester HaMalka says, if it's favorable to you, I would like to invite you and Haman to a mishteh. Okay, so Esther's invitation. Evite, if you will. Okay, a little mishteh Esther. I'm going to call this one mishteh number one, banquet number one. There's my mem. Okay, first banquet. And they get to the first banquet. And the king says, so what's up? What's this all about? What do you need? What's your request? She says, well, really what I'd like is for you to come to a second banquet. Okay, banquet number two. I'm going to put it here, but something happens in between. Okay, mishteh number two. Second banquet. And then I will reveal what it is that I need. Okay. In the meantime, Haman leaves the first banquet, only so happy with himself having secured the special attention of the queen. Whom should he meet on the way out? Mordechai, who refuses to bow down, and Haman is enraged. He goes home and he says, you know, I've been showered with all this attention by the queen, but you know, the whole thing is worthless to me. None of it is worth anything as long as that pesky Mordechai continues to annoy me. Right? There's a lesson in there, by the way, about focusing on what's important and what's less important in life. Sometimes you kind of like focus on what's really not that important in the great scheme of things, and it leads to your undoing. Okay. In any case, his wife suggests, Zeresh says, and all his ministers say, we have a great idea. Prepare a gallows, tell the king you want Mordechai hanged, and you'll be rid of him. So sure enough, early the next morning, which is the morning of the second mishteh, right? Haman decides to approach the king and to request that Mordechai be hanged. But something happens in between the first mishteh and the second mishteh. What happens? The king's sleep is disturbed. Right? He can't fall asleep. And of course, if you're in shul, when they read this in the Megillah, often the reader will make a huge deal at this moment, right? Balayla hahu nadada shenat ha-melech, right? As if we were talking about someone other than the king Ahasuerus, maybe the divine king, because that's the tune we introduce, a tune from Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, right? And the rabbis actually say, yes, nadada shnat malko shalolam, God's sleep was disturbed, as it were. So the rabbis are identifying this as potentially the turning point in the story. Okay, we'll come back to that. The king's sleep is disturbed. He asks that the chronicles be read. What should be revealed to him but that Mordechai had saved his life back in chapter 2, which is, by the way, I don't know how many years earlier. Nine years earlier. He had never been rewarded. Right? I got to do something, says the king. At that very moment, Haman enters. There's that confluence again, that convergence. How shall we reward the man that honors the king? Haman says, oh, he must be talking about me. Right? So, put him on the king's horse, let him wear a crown, the rest of it. Hashvirosh says, great, do that for Mordechai. Okay? Haman now parades Mordechai through the streets of the city. Right? And he just makes it home breathless to describe his tale of woe to those that are present, his wife and his friends. But lo and behold, the second mishteh is about to happen, and he is hurried off in order to attend. Okay? So an awful lot of narrative material unfolds in between the first banquet of Esther and the second banquet of Esther. That's really my point. And now we're in chapter 7. Okay? Chapter 7, the second banquet. King turns to Esther and says, "What's up?" She says, "Well, this guy Haman actually turns out to be a dangerous, murderous enemy." Right? So Esther accuses Haman, and he is quickly deposed. Okay, but bureaucracy being what it is, once the king issues a decree, it's impossible to take it back. So in spite of the fact that Haman is out of the way pretty quickly, right? In spite of that, we're still dealing with Haman's decree, which has already circulated in the realm. What are we going to do about that? We have to write a new decree that will allow the Jews to defend themselves. Okay, and the king gives permission, Mordechai summons the scribes and the runners once again, and that all happens on the third month, 23rd day. New decree is publicized. Okay, the third month is the month of Sivan, as the text reports. So if I do the math, what do I discover? From the moment that Haman issued his decree to destroy the Jews, which was the 13th day of the first month, until the counter decree is now issued after Haman has been deposed, 70 days have elapsed. That's it. Another way to think about it is pretty much the events from the beginning of chapter 3 until the end of chapter 8 all take place over the course of 70 days. The Megillah itself takes place over the course of a decade. But most of the Megillah takes place over the course of just over 2 months, which must mean that we're doing an awful lot of compression in terms of the framing and an awful lot of development in terms of the core. Okay? So most of the narrative material takes place over a relatively short period of time, even though the framing of the story is much longer than that. Okay? Okay, the new decree is offered, and sure enough, what happens? When that day rolls around, I'm in chapter 9 now. Oh, I forgot something, sorry. After this decree is publicized, Mordechai is paraded through the streets of Shushan, b'tachrich boots v'argaman, in this royal attire. V'ha'ir Shushan tzahala v'samecha le'yehudim hayta orav v'simcha v'sason. Was it Hazako? Orav v'simcha v'sason v'ikar, right? And there's a mishten there as well. I'm in chapter 8. The text says, mishteh v'yom tov, that the Jews make a mishteh and a yom tov on the day that Mordechai is paraded through the city. Okay? So another mishteh. I guess you might call it mishteh Mordechai, if you wanted to name it. Okay? On the day of his triumph. But don't forget, this mishteh is a little premature, because that old decree is still hovering in the air that the Jews are slated for destruction the following Adar. Okay, following Adar rolls around, the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, the 13th day, which was the day that Haman had selected, and what did the Jews do? They defend themselves against their foes. Now you might say, well, what's the difference? Even without the king's decree, they may have defended themselves. It's true, I suppose. But if you have state support, it makes all the difference in the world. Now they have state support to defend themselves. And so that's what they do. And they fight on the 13th day in order to preserve their lives. Okay? In the city of Shushan, the fighting continues into the 14th day. But only in Shushan. Okay? As a result of that, two discrete observances begin to emerge. The Jews of Shushan versus the Jews of the rest of the realm. The Jews of the rest of the realm fight and defend themselves on the 13th, and what do they do on the 14th day of Adar? They feast, they rest. Okay? The Jews of Shushan fight on the 13th day, and on the 14th day, what do they do on the 15th day of Adar? They celebrate Shushan Purim. Okay? So, what ultimately happens is, we have these two versions of observing Purim, right? The Jews of the realm and the Jews of Shushan. The Jews of the realm celebrate on the 14th day, and the Jews of Shushan celebrate on the 15th day. And both of these are described as Mishte v'Simcha. Okay? And with that, the story ends. I know there's a little mopping up at the end because we have to turn this into a commemoration, which Esther and Mordechai then do, and that's the final letters that are sent, the final igrot, and the rest of it. Ki yamuvu ki blu aleihem val zaram, the people of Israel took it upon themselves for all generations to observe the festival or festivals of Purim. Those that dwell in the unwalled cities will observe it on the 14th. The Jews of Shushan will observe it on the 15th. Bechol shana v'shana, from one year to the next. Okay? Any questions on that? Easy, right? 167 verses, 10 chapters, which doesn't mean anything because chapters are just arbitrary. Okay, it's not the product of Jewish tradition, but 167 verses pretty much. Roughly something like a decade or so of time, but the majority of it is actually 70 very intense days. Okay, from the time that the first decree by Haman is publicized until the time that the second decree canceling the first is publicized, and all of the intrigue that unfolds in between, roughly 70 days of time. Okay. So I want people to note that. I also want you to note the following, that if you did the math, and I hope I did it right too, you should have discovered that Megillat Esther has how many banquets in it? I know. How many? Ten. There are exactly 10 banquets. There are exactly 10 chapters. That really is a coincidence, because chapters have nothing to do with it. Okay? But there are 10 banquets. That's intriguing, I would say. Okay? I'm going to go a step further and suggest to you that if we look carefully at the banquets, we will discover, I'm tempted to say, something amazing. Maybe I'll save it a little bit, because I like to kind of build up suspense. Okay, but just keep in mind that we've got 10 banquets here, okay? And you might say, if I sort of look at the sweep of the story, it's not an exaggeration to suggest that every single significant moment, turning point, if you will, in the story has a banquet associated with it, has a mishteh. It's not an accident that when Purim is halachicized, as it were, banquet occupies a central place in the observance because it's central to the story. Okay? Every moment in the story is triggered by a banquet. Whether it's Vashti's demise or Esther's election or Haman's plot or his overthrow or the salvation of the Jews, It's all about banquets. Or at least it's marked by banquets. Okay? So that's part one. Part two. I mentioned earlier to you that there seems to be a pretty clear feature of the Megillah, that God's name is absent. Okay, so I want to sharpen that and suggest to you it's not simply that God's name is absent, but I would put it in slightly different language. I would say God has been written out. Someone is up to no good here because God has been deliberately written out of the story. Let me explain what I mean by that. It's not simply the fact that God isn't mentioned. We have that in Shir HaShirim too, more or less, until you get to the end. Right? It's that there are moments in the story where, in every other Tanakh moment that's similar to the Megillah one, the focus would have been on God. Let me give you an example. Chapter 2, we are told that Mordechai was exiled. Asher hoglam Yerushalayim. Okay? Well, exile, for goodness sake, that's a classic moment to recall God's role in the process. It might have said something like, not Asher heglam Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel, but Asher heglam Hashem me'artzam. And I'm not just saying that intuitively, because that's exactly how it works in the book of Daniel. When we hear about Daniel, who's a little bit earlier than the events of the Megillah, when we hear about the exile from Jerusalem, which brings Daniel to Babylon, chapter 1, the text leaves no doubt whatsoever that God did the exiling. And here we have a verse devoted to exile, Asher hoglam Yerushalayim im hagola Asher hoglata im Yechoniah melech Yehuda Asher hegla Nebuchadnezzar melech Bavel. Four mentions of exile in one verse, and no mention of God. So I would argue that's deliberate. Somebody intentionally took out the divine reference. And it just goes on and on like this. When Esther finds favor, Vatitav, Hanna'ara be'enav, in the eyes of Haggai, who looks after... That's got to be like a play on words, that name, no? Haggai, right? The guy, the one responsible for the harem, right? When she... That's a joke, folks. When she finds favor in Haggai's eyes, right? Vatitav hanna'ara be'enav, vatisa chesed lifanav, she found favor before him. That's number one. Esther, the text reports again in chapter 2, Vatihi Esther noset chen be'enei kol roeha, she found favor in everybody's eyes. When she's about to be selected by the king, Vatisa chen v'chesed lefanav mikol habitulot, she finds favor and mercy in his eyes more than any of the other virgins. Yeah, slip of the tongue there. Chen v'chesed, you know my joke on that, no? Yeah, okay, well, not everyone. Maybe I'll tell it anyways, right? So other faith traditions talk about like 70 virgins. That's like the ideal. Wow, 70 virgins. We talk about 70 versions, right? What could be more pleasurable than that, right? Just like discussing the Torah, Shivim Panim La Torah, and the rest of it. 70 virgins is like Olam Haba. All right, anyways. So it says Esther found compassion and grace in the eyes of everyone. What should it have said? If I were talking about, for instance, the story of Yosef in the house of Potiphar, this is repeated over and over again. God gave him favor in Potiphar's eyes. The exact same words, the same phrase, chen v'chesed. If I'm talking about Daniel in the eyes of the king's ministers, Daniel's trying to get a kosher meal over there, but he doesn't want to upset the apple cart. Luckily, God gives him favor in the eyes of the ministers. So when we talk about someone finding favor, you might say, miraculously, in other places in Tanakh, it's very clear how that happens. How does it happen? God is involved. So once again, I would argue, have a moment in the story when God should have been mentioned and deliberately was omitted. And this is how it continues. U'Mordechai lo yichvava lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai refused to bow down. Why? Well, in the book of Daniel version, we know why Daniel and his cohorts refused to bow down to the golden image of the king. It's very clear why. The text tells us. Because they're devotees of God. Why would you leave out that critical detail? Of course that's why he refuses. Right? So it's not simply an omission, that's my point. It's that there are points in the story where it's clear that we're dealing with divine involvement, and we refuse to say it explicitly. Right? The people will ask Mordechai, why do you refuse to bow down? He should have answered, as Yonah did, Ivri Anochi. Vet Hashem Elokei Hashamayim V'Haaretz Ani Yareh Asher Asa Atayam V'Et Hayabasha. People want to know why you're behaving strangely with the ritual thing. Well, you tell them, I'm Jewish. That's what Mordechai should have done, but it's left unanswered. Madua ata over et mitzvat hamelech in chapter 4. Haman will talk about the Jews, v'datehem shonot mikol am. They're different than everybody. They don't do anything that anyone else does. We might have expected there to be a mention in there, something about the God that they worship, but there isn't. And then it just gets out of hand completely. Chapter 4. Mordechai is in a fit of mourning. He dons sackcloth, and he sits in ashes, and he cries out, Vayizag ze'aka gedola umara. What's that if not an opportunity for telling us who he's crying out to? Isn't it obvious? He's crying out to God. Esther will say, declare a fast. 3 days, don't eat, don't drink. To what end? Obviously, to find compassion in God's eyes. To sway the decree. That's the book of Jonah in miniature. Remember chapter 3. The king of Nineveh will declare a fast, and everyone will get on board real quick. And what will it say? They cried out to God, El HaElokim, Bechozka, with strength. And guess what God heard? And that's the centerpiece in the book of Jonah. So here's a moment when we have an opportunity to spell out God's role in the story, his centrality to the story, and we refuse to do it. Okay. It goes on and on. I mean, do you need more proof, or is that enough? It's enough, right? Just carry the story through every moment where you can sort of imagine in your own mind a moment of triumph, a moment of challenge, a moment of defeat, a moment of victory. Every other place in Tanakh, it's a moment where God is center stage, and in Megillat Esther, he is nowhere to be seen. Okay? So that's what I mean. Whoever put this together is up to something. As if God has been deliberately expunged from the text. Removed. So the question isn't simply where is God in the story, but why on earth has he been removed from the story? To what end? Okay. I want to briefly come back to the 10 banquets before we talk about some kind of solution to all this. I'm going to say the following. Very often we think, those of us that kind of have heard the story read in synagogue a few times or even read it on our own, we think to ourselves, the turning point of the story is, what's the turning point of the story? What would you say the turning point of the story is? Okay, could be. I hear that. When she accuses Haman, right? I mean, that's certainly a turning point. Does it start a little earlier than that?
Yeah, when he pulls on the couch.
When he falls down at her feet on the couch and the king misinterprets it, maybe. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so when the king says, take Mordechai and put him on the horse and the rest of it, i.e. that's in the aftermath of the king's sleep being disturbed. That's a classic approach, by the way. The sleep of the king disturbed at the beginning of chapter 6 is the turning point of the story, which is my suspicion as to why that ended up as chapter 6, by the way, right out of 10 chapters, because whoever was thinking that, right, imagined to himself that this is the turning point of the story. So I want to suggest something else entirely. And the way to appreciate it is to think of the Mishta'ot. Okay? Remember how we started. We had two banquets of the king. Banquet number one, 180 days. Banquet number two, 7 days. These were both banquets of the king. Okay? Then we had a banquet of Vashti. Her banquet. Then we had a banquet that Haman basically prepares over his joy concerning the destruction of the Jews. Right? Then we have what? Esther has two banquets. Right? Two banquets. Did I miss something? I hope not. Right? And it's in that second banquet that Haman will be exposed. Right? Thank you. That's important. Okay, Esther is queen banquet. So there's a banquet thrown in her honor. Then two banquets of Esther. Then there is Mordechai being paraded banquet. And then there are the two final banquets. Banquet number one, you might call it, which is about the realm. And banquet number two, which is about Shushan. And my gosh, I just sort of figured it out in a way that I didn't figure it out before. Right, so what I would like to suggest to you is there is a definite structure to all this. If we were looking at it from a literary lens, we would call it a chiastic structure. What does a chiastic structure mean? It means that something at the beginning parallels something at the end. So A is A1, and B is B1, and C is C1. And what tends to happen in a chiastic structure is we focus our attention on the center of the story. Right? So look at this. Banquet number one, 180 days, for the people of the realm. Banquet number two, 7 days, for the people of Shushan. Parallels, banquet number one at the end for the people, the Jews of the realm. Banquet number two at the end for the Jews of Shushan. Does that not parallel? Yeah. And you're saying it should be reversed, but I don't know if it has to be reversed necessarily. The point is these two banquets parallel those two banquets. Okay? The banquet of Vashti, which is to say Vashti being, I guess, in the process of being deposed, not quite, parallels the banquet of Mordechai in the sense that Vashti is removed from the king's presence and Mordechai is the favorite of the king in that version. Right? So Mordechai is paraded on the king's horse and the rest of it. This is how the one who serves the king is rewarded. Right, which parallels, of course, Vashti being deposed for refusing to serve the king. Okay? Haman throws a banquet, and Esther throws a has a banquet thrown in her honor, and the two banquets of Esther pretty much focus on Haman and Esther. Right? So the first banquet, she doesn't reveal why it is that she is inviting Haman. It's, as it were, her secret. And in the second banquet, Haman is exposed. So I want to make an argument that these two banquets parallel those two banquets, which is another way of saying the core of the story is right over there. That's the core of the story. something in between the banquet thrown for Esther becoming queen and Esther's first banquet in honor of Haman. So what happens in between? Yeah.
She goes before the king.
She goes before the king. And before she goes before the king? The Jews fast for 3 days. Does that make sense as being, quote unquote, the turning point of the story? Which is to say, isn't tshuva always the turning point of the story? In the Tanakh it is. The turning point of the story is always tshuva. Right? If you look at the book of Jonah, that's exactly what happens. Right? Tshuva turns the story. That's what it is. Tshuva is a pivot point. That's what it is. So actually, the turning point of the story is not chapter 6. It's the end of chapter 4. The beginning of chapter 5. The Jews fast for 3 days, Laila Vayom. That is the turning point. And by the way, if I wanted to sharpen it a little bit, I might say, this is all about feasts and banqueting. But what's really at the core of the story? Fasting. Not feasts and banqueting. That's the core of the story. That's where the story begins to move in a different direction. Because of that fasting. Okay? So once again, I guess what I want to suggest, if we kind of take this and begin to assemble the pieces, is we have a deliberate literary construction in Megillat Esther. As deliberate as this is, which I think it is very deliberate, because the number 10 isn't just luck. It might be. Okay? The parallel banquets are not just luck. They might be. But it seems to me that we're pointed to some sort of a core idea here, which stands in glaring contrast to feasting and partying. And at the same time, as I said, we look at the larger frame and we keep expecting to see God revealed, and he's nowhere to be seen. Now the question is how we connect these dots. So I want to offer you three different theories as to why God is not mentioned in the Megillah. But it's the fourth one that we're ultimately going to consider. So I'm just going to tell you these in very short order. Ibn Ezra says, and he's a rationalist, right? He's writing in the 12th century. He says, it's clear from the Megillah that the Megillah is going to be transcribed by non-Jews. What do I mean by that? It enters into the annals of the Persian kings. At least that's what the Megillah says. So if it enters into the annals of the Persian kings, that means that Persians are recording the events. What's going to happen when God's name is mentioned in the story and Persians record the events? They're going to convert God into a Persian deity. And that's what we want to avoid. Call it, if you will, protecting God's identity. We don't want God to be transformed into a Persian deity, do we? Of course not, says Ibn Ezra. So better not to mention him. Just leave it out. We'll figure it out. It's not that hard. Deliberately leave out the name of God, because to introduce the name of God is to risk the possibility that his sanctity, the sanctity of his name, will be compromised when the story is recorded by the Persians and the Medes. Okay, that's a medieval interpretation. You've got modern interpretations. You've got somebody called Adele Berlin, who for many years headed up the Bible department at Maryland. And she wrote about Megillat Esther, some beautiful, beautiful articles. And she says, basically, you know, forget about all that divinity stuff and forget about all that divine authorship stuff and forget all of it, because the truth is Megillat Esther is nothing more than a comedy. Right? It's a comedy. It's a comedy that is meant to explain the Jews' practice of carnival. All peoples have carnival. Mardi Gras, whatever it is. The Jews had a carnival of their own. But we had to somehow justify it religiously, so we created a text to explain it. That's the way she understands it. The story, as it were, follows the practice rather than the other way around. The way the Megillah presents it, first we had the practice, you know, the story, whatever it was. Sorry, first we had the story, and then the practices evolve around the story. She says, no. First we had the practice called carnival. We had to explain that, justify it. So let's create a text that kind of can explain the origins of Purim. Don't take it seriously, she says, because it never happened. After all, it's not really recorded in the annals of the Persian kings, is it? We haven't found any queen called Esther. We haven't found any minister called Mordechai. So it's all a bluff. And because it's a comedy, of course you're not going to include God in there, because why would you? God isn't, it's not the place to talk about God's role when you're partying and carousing and drinking and fighting and having fun and going crazy. That's not a place to mention God. By the way, has anyone ever read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich? I didn't think so. It's a very long book. You read it? Yeah, of course, Michael. It's over 1,000 pages long. Okay? Guess how many pages in that book is taken up by the Holocaust? You think it's an important part of the story, no? For us, that's all it's about. Ask the average Jew, what can you tell me about the rise and fall of the Third Reich? They'll say, the Holocaust. So why is it only 30 pages long in that book? It's not that he's an anti-Semite, folks. It's that from his perspective, it's not really that important. Because if I'm looking at it in terms of the overall framing of the Second World War, the Holocaust actually looms pretty small, I hate to say it. But for the Jews, it's like everything. That's Purim, folks. There's a reason why the Persians don't record it. Because they don't care. Does it really matter to them, 70 days in Jewish history? Martin Gilbert would have been interested. But they're not. It doesn't really, what I'm saying is, I'm responding to that charge that the events of the Megillah are not recorded in the Persian annals. So what? There's lots of things that aren't recorded. People record those events that are significant to them, not the events that are significant to me. In any case, that's her argument. It is a comedy and nothing more. Menachem Liebtag, who's coming at it from a more traditional perspective, says, it's not exactly a comedy, it's more like a satire. What does a satire mean? It's a social commentary on the Jews in exile. The Jews in exile surrendered their identity. They surrendered the temple and Jerusalem and everything that was precious and dear, and instead they embraced the palace of Ahasuerus. What a tragedy, he says. Diaspora Jewry in the Persian Empire, a temple stands in Jerusalem waiting for devotees to build a Jewish state, and diaspora Jews just remain behind. Of course, he has an agenda, which is a Zionist narrative. But the point is, for him, it's not a comedy, it's a satire. A satire meaning a critique of the Jews in the kingdom of the king, right? And the absence of God's name is for a very simple reason, because for them, Ahasuerus is God. You know that curious rabbinic Midrash that every time it says HaMelech in the Megillah, it's really referring to God? That's a Midrash, obviously, but it's a Midrash that has some profound, deep idea associated with it. That as Jews in the Persian Empire, it's possible to imagine that the gods I worship are not the gods of my ancestors or the god of my ancestor, but the king who sits on that throne in the capital at Shushan, in his temple-like building. And Liebtag makes a huge deal out of the parallels between the king's palace and the temple in Jerusalem, and there are many, or the ornamentation of that palace and the ornamentation of the temple, and there are many parallels to be drawn. That's his interpretation. So they're all good. I guess they all explain the absence of God's name, but I'd like to suggest something else. Oh boy, here we go, the last 5 minutes. I'm supposed to finish on time, and we have take five, and Mayor's going to get upset, and Karen's going to be in here, and it's not going to be pretty. So we got to kind of compress it, okay? Here's what I want to say. Really quick, I'm going to have to tell you this, but I'll pay. Okay, the Ramban says the following, Nachmanides. Right, great 13th century Spanish commentary. What does he say? He's not talking about Megillat Esther when he says it. He's talking about Exodus chapter 13. Right, this month will be for you the first of months, the month of the Exodus. Right, the first month, he says, is the month of the Exodus. That's its name, the first month. And that's how we count in the Tanakh. The months don't have names. Okay, they're simply ordinal numbers. Ordinal numbers means there's an order there. There's a reference point. The first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth. What's the reference point? The Exodus from Egypt. The pivotal moment in biblical history. Analogous to the days of the week that don't have any names. The first day in Hebrew. First day, the second day, the third day, etc. Why? Because there's a reference point. What's the reference point? Shabbat. The days of creation, right, revolve around Shabbat. So that's how it used to be. The reason why we count it that way is to remember the Exodus. Okay? But something strange happened on the way to Babylon. What happened was when the first temple was destroyed and the Jews went into exile, they suddenly gave their months different names. So the first month became Nisan. And the second month became Iyar. And the third month became Sivan, etc. And between you and me, they don't sound like particularly Jewish words. And the Rabban says they're not Jewish words. They're Persian words. They're Babylonian words. They're Assyrian words. Okay? We took the names of the months from our Babylonian hosts when we went into exile. I know. Now the Ramban says, I told you, now the Ramban says, okay, just like we commemorated the first redemption, because it's really not about exile, it's about redemption. We commemorated the first redemption by naming our months after that pivotal moment. Now we commemorate the second redemption, the redemption from Babylonian exile, by naming our months after that moment. And that's all he says. Okay? Now this is terribly ironic in the modern era because you'll meet many very observant Jews that will refuse to write the secular month on their checks and will only write Nisan, Iyar, Sivan, etc. Right? In spite of the fact that these are Babylonian, Persian, and Assyrian gods. But ironies abound in life. That's not my point. Okay? This is my point. The Ramban leaves it at that. I want to explore the implications of it. What does it mean that in the second redemption, quote unquote, we took the names of the months associated with Babylon and Persia and Assyria and the rest of it? What does it really mean? I'll tell you what it means. What it means is when we left exile behind, we didn't entirely leave exile behind. Some of it came with us in how we mark our time. You know, the rabbis comment in Megillat Esther and they say the following. Why don't we say Hallel on Purim? After all, it's a joyous day and all. And the answer is, one answer is, we're not free. We're still serving Ahasuerus. You want us to say Hallel like the Exodus from Egypt? That was a moment of freedom and liberation. To be freed from the pharaohs, finally, and irrevocably. But that's not what Purim was about. Because in the aftermath of the Purim miracle, quote unquote, we still serve the Persian kings. I would submit to you, the reason why God has been deliberately removed from Megillat Esther is to highlight the transformation in our situation. Exodus was about overt miracles. That's what it was. And you remember that story, I'm sure. Now, you can deal with miracles in whatever way you deal with it. It doesn't really matter. The point is this. When we talk about an overt miracle, what we're talking about, divine intervention in the story in an explicit and obvious and overt fashion. That's what it means. But those were the good old days. And the condition after the exile is no longer the same. God is more subtle. God is more hidden. Or as the rabbis put it, the name Esther means, based on a verse in Dvarim, Hasteir astir panai, I will hide my face, says God. To what end? Well, you might say divine displeasure, that's certainly part of it. But the other part of it is, I would say the flip side of the coin is, the more divine hiding, the more human initiative is possible. And Megillat Esther is about human initiative. It's about Esther making a decision that's going to be faithful for her and for her people. Does she have the courage or does she not? She will wait for a miracle in vain because it won't happen. We're past that period of Jewish history. We've got to make the decisions and hope and pray that God gives us success. And that's what Megillat Esther is about. So as much as this is a story about divine hiddenness, the flip side of that is, it is a story about human initiative. The rabbis put it very beautifully. They say the following, and I know I have to finish. I need 2 more minutes. They say the following. The Jews stood at Mount Sinai, right? This is a Gemara on Shabbat. And God lifted the mountain over their heads, and what did he say? You know this Midrash, I'm sure it's a Pardes classic. What did he say? Accept the Torah or perish. That's the choice. Which, between you and me, is not much of a choice. Right? Either the mountain comes crashing down, or I accept the Torah. Is that a choice? Not really. You have it in your sources. So the Chachamim say, wait a second here, if that's really the case, so it was coercion, for goodness sake. The Jews didn't accept the Torah because they wanted to. Why do we have to accept it to this day? What does the Gemara answer? Hadar kibluha bimei Achashverosh. The Jews re-accepted the Torah in the days of Achashverosh. Why? Because it says in the Megillah, ki yamu v'kiblu. They took on and they accepted the rites of Purim. So what is that contrast about? Exactly our discussion. In the Mount Sinai frame of things, there is no room for human initiative. Either you accept the divine fiat or you perish. That's the choice. Most of us would probably choose to accept. Mount Sinai is miraculous intervention. Mount Sinai is overt presence of God. Nobody refuses that overture. So the good news is that you have an expression of God's involvement which is overt and overwhelming. The bad news is the more overt and overwhelming it is, the less choice we actually have to embrace it. Along comes Purim and says, there's another way of looking at things. In this version of the story, God is absent entirely. He's not there. Which is another way of saying, if you want salvation, folks, you're going to have to choose it. You're going to have to take the initiative, and you're going to have to do it on your own. And that's the invitation of Purim. I want to end with one last thought, and this is really it. Okay? And that is the following. I don't want people to think for a moment that when I talk about divine silence, I'm talking about absence. Okay, when I talk about hiddenness, I am not talking about absence. God is present. God is involved. God is helping things along. The convergences are the divine design unfolding. Because once I make the choice, I don't know where it goes. Because there's other people out there making other choices. And how it's all going to ultimately come together is beyond my control. That's the power of divine intervention in the convergences. If I were to ask you, who are the least likely instruments in Megillat Esther for redemption? What would you say? The least likely instruments. Haman. Who else? Achashverosh. Certainly. A lottery. Okay, those two especially, you would not think are the instruments of redemption. If I were to ask you what is the least likely setting for redemption to break forth, you would probably say, Amishteh. A banquet, a drunken banquet? Why on earth would God use that as his instrument of choice? And yet, when Esther unleashes her very first banquet, which is the turning point in the story, by the way, and she invites these two clowns to attend. And there's going to be lots of drinking. You don't have to bring your own bottle. We're going to have fun, guys. Just show up. So what does she say? And this isn't my idea. It's in the Midrash somewhere, but I can't tell you where. In one of these years, I will find it. I'm in chapter 5. She says the following. Yavo HaMelech VeHaman Hayom El HaMishteh Asher Asiti Lahem. Okay. That's God in the story. For those that are looking. Okay? It's precisely the moment. It's precisely the characters. It's precisely the setting. Okay? So, we spoke about a God who's been written out. Because exile is a period of divine hiding, which is an opportunity for human initiative. But even as that hiding seems so overwhelming sometimes, we should bear in mind that it doesn't mean absence. It means an opportunity for human beings to leave their mark, to be the partners in redemption, as it were, which is what Esther is at that precise moment. Okay, we're going to stop here for now. I can take off this hat.